Hello, Lois.
Hi, Carl. How are you?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
Yes.
Welcome to my podcast, A Life in Biography. We're here, of
Thank
course, to talk about your biography of Greta Garbo. Why don't we start by you telling us a little bit about yourself and then how you got interested in Garbo?
Oh, okay. Well, have been a professor at the University of Southern California in the History and Gender Studies programs, and I'm now retired, and I spend my time researching and writing. So I had written a biography of Marilyn Monroe, and I wanted to go back in time and look at the 1920s to 1940s in terms of a great star. And it was Garbo, obviously, that I was drawn to because of her very interesting career and also that she was so good in silent films. I've never studied silent films.
Yeah, that's a really good reason. I've become much more interested in silent film since working on a biography of Ronald Colman, whose the first part of his career was entirely in silent film, and then he goes into talkies, and people think, "My God, what a voice!"
They did the same with Garbo, of
That's
course.
right. Yeah, exactly. There's a parallel there. In fact, and temperamentally, he was sometimes compared to Garbo because of his shying away from the public spotlight, publicity, that sort of thing. So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, she didn't like to have fans, but she had to have fans. And so they and but she gave terrible interviews, which is ironic. But she did. And so they decided to publicize her as the mystery woman of Hollywood. She was very happy with that because it gave her leave not to have to give interviews.
That's right. Yeah. Well, now, like Marilyn Monroe, there's been so much written about Garbo. So why did you decide to do it anyway? You didn't say, well, there have been biographies, I don't need to do one.
I felt that there was a problem with the biographies. In the first place, I didn't think they gave a full recording of Garbo in their narratives. And I decided to look into the Swedish sources. So I learned to read Swedish and I read German. So I was able to look into archive collections in Germany and Sweden that no one had ever paid much attention to. So I was able to teach at the University of Uppsala for a year under a Fulbright grant. And then I had 6 months at the American Academy in Berlin. So I really did get access to the original manuscript sources through those two grants.
Yes, and I can tell in your biography that you did, not only looking at your notes, but the way you crafted the book was very much an awareness of what had already been written about Garbo, but what still needed to be said. I think that's an important part of what you're doing in the book. Now, yeah, go ahead.
Well, Barry Paris, who's a good biographer of Garbo, said that she never gave any interviews. Well, she did give interviews, but they were in Sweden. And in
Aha,
Sweden,
yeah.
she did give interviews in the United States. And that's where all of her own stories about her life existed, were in Swedish sources.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference. It's often the case when there's a new biography, even of a figure who's been much studied and written about, it's often because the biographer has found new sources. I have to say, in your case, that's real dedication, learning Swedish to do this biography.
Well, I just thought I'd try it. I can't speak it, but I read it.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at speaking languages, but I'm very good at learning to read them. And Swedish is a lovely language. It's very beautiful,
Yeah,
unlike
yeah.
English, it's quite harsh.
Yeah. So, one of the things you say in your biography, and anyone who knows your work knows that you're a historian of beauty, and that word beauty is in the title of your biography. Let's talk a little bit about that, about standards of beauty and where Garbo fits in, and what did it mean, her moving from Europe a different culture, and then finding yourself in Hollywood.
Yeah, the title of my book is ironic. In other words, ideal beauty. She, for a long time, was not an ideal beauty. She was the most often ridiculed star in Hollywood, according to the great newspaper columnist Luella Parsons, and there was a lot of criticism of her in the newspaper commentary on her, particularly in the fan magazines. And that started from the beginning of her coming to the United States. She was in New York, and pictures were taken of her with her mentor, Stiller, Mert Stiller, on the boat when they landed. And she was wearing what was obviously a cheap, inexpensive version of fashionable clothing, and she was ridiculed for having done that. So that started the ridicule, which to a certain extent never stopped.
That's a curious fact about her. How did she respond to that?
She didn't respond much at all. She would rant and rave, according to the sources I read, when she was at home, and she'd rant and rave to her lovers and her agent, but she would never respond publicly to the criticism, which may have been wise on her part, may have been a mistake. I'm not too certain.
Yeah,
but I think if she had responded, she would just have gotten more of the same, because she was the comics on, they didn't have television yet, but the radio comics and the comics on stage would refer to her, and she would be the butt of their jokes. At the same time that she was being extolled for her acting ability on the screen, it was a very strange kind of misconnect.
That's one of the really surprising things when I read your book and reviewed it for the New York Sun, is I had no idea how much criticism there was. And it ties into, as you said, your ironic title, to use a cliche, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Well, when you get to Hollywood, you get all sorts of beholders. You get the cinematographers. You get the studio heads like Louis B. Mayer. You have an industry that you have to fit into. This should have, given Garbo's previous experience in Europe, just simply overwhelming. And yet she overcame that. How did she do that?
To become a great star?
Yeah.
She had many mentors. She had spent several years at the most important drama school for actresses in Europe, namely the Royal Swedish Academy of Dramatic Arts in Stockholm. And they were teaching almost a Stanislavski method, not completely, but they were doing a lot about internalizing roles at that particular point. She was well-trained when she came to Hollywood, which really hasn't been recognized. Very few stars had the training in acting that she had. And then she by both luck and her own design, was trained by a group of Hollywood actors who were superb. John Gilbert, for example.
Yeah.
He was her co-star. He lived with her for 3 years. She lived with him. She was in his house. He trained her. He really trained her in the Hollywood style. And he was very important to her. And Stiller trained her. Stiller was a very good director. He trained her. And then there were others that she responded to and, in a sense, worked with.
Yeah, there's a kind of on-the-job training. Yeah, and of course, she had to have the talent and the discipline to take advantage of all that advice. It reminds me, again, of Ronald Colman, who was a stage actor and didn't think he translated well to the screen until he did a play in New York, and the director, Henry King, saw him. And then he referred Colman to Lillian Gish, and they were about to do a film called The White Sister. And they liked the way he looked, and they liked the way he was performing in the Hollywood play. And then they took this ship to Italy, where they were going to shoot the film. And in effect, on that ship, Coleman had his introduction to Hollywood, how to act for the camera. So I think this the role of mentors, at least with certain actors, actors who have this incipient talent, is really helpful, especially if you're going to go into a situation like Garbo did, where you're going to face a lot of ridicule, which Coleman did not have to confront. But that's the other thing about someone like Greta Garbo, is the enormous inner resources she would have to deal with people like Louis B. Mayer, for example.
Well, according to her conversations with Cecil Beaton, the British photographer, she played games with Louis B. Mayer. She acted like a child, and then she absolutely refused to do what he wanted. He wasn't used to that. He wasn't used to someone who would talk back to him or just retreat into a place that he couldn't follow. So she was very good. She, according to some people, she was the only star who really was able to defeat Louis B. Mayer on a number of occasions. In her early career, after she made Flesh and the Devil with John Gilbert, which that was the film that made it into a star. It was her third or fourth film. And then after that, Louis B. Mayer tried to put her into a film that she was thought was terrible, and she was right. And then he basically put her on no pay, and she just didn't go to the studio. And they fought it out for a good 8 months until it was obvious that Flesh and the Devil was making her a huge star. And she won. He backed down.
Mm-hmm. Sounds a little like Marilyn Monroe.
Well, the same sort of thing. But there are similarities between Garbo and Monroe, but they're really very unobvious. And I was surprised to find them. I was surprised to find a lot that I found out about Garbo that no one had ever talked about before. Like her spiritual quest. I spent a lot of time tracking that down. She was looking for a religion, and also her illnesses. Everyone said she was hypochondriac, but she wasn't. She suffered terribly from illness. And also she chain smoked all her life. She lived in her early 80s, but even then she was still chain smoking, and she had a lot of illnesses, which they always tried to hide, of course.
And she was acting at a time, especially in the 20s, when there were no unions. Actors had very few rights, who were contract players. Working, you know, she had physical breakdowns, you describe, you know, difficulties performing. And yet she persisted. And unlike a lot of actresses of her generation, that is of the 20s generation, especially foreign-born actresses like Vilma Behnke, for example. She couldn't, Behnke could not make the transition to sound film. And Garbo did.
Yes, she did.
How was that possible?
Well, she had certain native talents, and her body was awkward, but she was a natural athlete. It's ironic. Everything about her is ironic. She was both sick all the time and a natural athlete. They taught her to move beautifully on screen. She's gorgeous in her silent film roles, where everything is about movement. And she couldn't dance. When they had her dance alone, as they do, for example, in Mata Hari, her movement's terrible. She can't really dance.
Yeah, she made the most, I guess you would say. It's interesting. It was interesting to me reading your book. When she arrives in Hollywood, there is a standard of beauty, and there's a certain size a woman is supposed to be, sort of a Mary Pickford size. Maybe you could be a little bit taller than that, but not too tall. And Garbo was what, 5'7"?
Yeah,
5'7".
She was very tall for that period. And yes, Mary Pickford was 5 feet tall, and you really shouldn't be taller than about 5'3". That was the height. It filmed better. I've never felt that was true, but that's my eyes as contrasted with the eyes of the directors and producers in the 1920s.
Yes.
Who really liked the small women better.
Talk a bit about one of her films, Queen Christina, because you have a quite a interesting take on that film, what it meant to Garbo, how Louis B. Mayer treated that film, and it had a huge impact on Garbo and on her career.
She loved doing Queen Christina. Queen Christina is very well known in Sweden. They still talk about her today. She was a maverick queen. She was short with a beaky nose, but she was a dynamo of action. And she was also perhaps even transgendered. It's hard to say, but she was like Garbo, tough and brilliant in terms of what she did. She brought acting troops to Sweden. She created Swedish Swedish theater, and it was the next monarch, Gustav III, who then founded the Royal Swedish Dramatic Academy, which did become world famous. And that's where Garbo went, and that's where she was initially trained. And she was a stage actress at first, but curiously, the whole time she was in Hollywood, she never acted on the stage. And I tried to figure out why, and what I came up with was exactly what she said. She said she didn't have enough energy to perform in a role night after night. And I went with that insight and went deeply into her illnesses, which previous biographers had noted, but they thought most of them were because she was a hypochondriac. That's not true. She had many, many chronic illnesses that troubled her, particularly that smoking, but she was never able to stop the smoking.
Yeah, it's illness plays such an important role in an actor's life, especially if it's some kind of chronic condition. It was true of Marilyn Monroe. There were lots of stories about her, being in the hospital and rumors or she's having an abortion. And mm-hmm. I know that, she had endometriosis. There were many other reasons for her hospitalizations, but they were, narrowed down to this one idea. And it seems that with Garbo biography, you get some of the same kind of inability to take seriously what the actress is telling you. Monroe mm-hmm. couldn't, I think, pretty much concluded the same thing. To do it night after night would cause a physical breakdown. It was bad mm-hmm. enough for Garbo on the sets where she, I'm not sure people know this, but mentally and physically, movie acting can be a very, demanding, exhausting, enervating activity.
In Garbo's day, they would make a film in a short a period as 5 weeks. But when they were filming, there were constant interruptions for lighting, for something wrong with the scene, for an actor forgetting his or her line. So they were always being interrupted. And that was very difficult. Now, Garbo had many positive characteristics that could lead to her acting. For example, she had a photographic memory. She could memorize all the lines in a film, everybody's line, which is quite something. She also had a problem with noise. She had hypersensitive hearing. So if any noise occurred, she couldn't handle it. And they had to get her sets very, very quiet for her so that she perform. And that was another thing that happened. And she became so good that ultimately by the after about four films, she was directing herself. They weren't directing her. And they put black screens around her so that she didn't hear any noise on the set. And then the directors finally, because of her very temperamental personality, her ability to become interestingly and curiously ill at the drop of a hat, they would direct her through a hole in the black sets. And finally, really, she directed herself.
Yeah.
Because she was really good. And they just sat there, and George Cukor, who was a very famous director in that period, he would basically keep her in a very supportive environment, and she would actually direct what she did, her movements, her actions, etc. So that was kind of very unusual for actors in that period to have that kind of coddling and freedom.
And directors often don't understand that. Cukor did, but a lot mm-hmm. of directors just simply saw the actress or the actor as obstinate. If you're a star and you're making film after film, as Garbo did, you have a certain sense of what works in front of the camera. The directors mm-hmm. change, but you don't change. And that's, well, that's often where you get the conflict, the tension mm-hmm. of a director who's not actor sensitive, doesn't realize that, and is sometimes asking the actor to do things that the actor knows isn't quite right for her role. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's all true, very true. Mm-hmm. And Garbo, like many major stars, tried to get directors that she appreciated or that appreciated her. So she had a lot of the same people directing her films, because that became easier for her to do what she wanted.
Yeah, yeah. You have quite a bit of discussion in your biography about her sexuality, and mm-hmm. given her the glamour with which she was portrayed in her, certainly in her mature films and her later films, say a little bit about that, about her sexuality.
Well, she, for the most part, identified herself as a young homosexual man, but she actually, in her own personal relationships, sexual or otherwise, she was bisexual. She wanted to marry a man, and it was not just to get someone to cover over her masculine side, but it was because she wanted to, in some sense, lead a heteronormative life.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially given the time and the culture that she was in. It makes a great deal of sense. She makes a fascinating comparison with Marlene Dietrich, too. They both cross-dress to some extent, and they both had, I think, affairs with men and women.
Mm-hmm. That is all true. Marlene Dietrich once says, and I think it's true of Garbo as well, we European women, we make love with anyone who attracts us, and we don't pay any attention to their gender. And I think that Garbo did that too. There are instances which I think are pretty correct, instances in which women will say that she tried to seduce them, sometimes successfully. She certainly seduced Salka Viertel, because Viertel recorded it in a letter to her husband in great detail. And Viertel, of course, was the German actress who came to Hollywood and eventually was responsible for bringing many Jewish actors and directors during Hitler's time to Hollywood. Viertel was famous for that. And Viertel also was renowned as Greta Garbo's coach. But as so much in Garbo's life, Viertel tried to control her. Garbo didn't want to be controlled, but she let Viertel take over. That very complex personality that Garbo had, always wanting someone to control her, but not to be controlled. Very complicated, the way it worked out in her life.
Yeah, I can see that. I'm thinking about as she gets into sound film, into the talkies, and into comedy with a film like Ninotchka, which is a great success. And then she ends her career.
Well, she She does a couple of films after Ninotchka. That's not her last film. And some people think that her film Camille, Les Dames au Camille, was her best film. I don't happen to like it when she goes into these epic dramatic roles and goes back to a certain kind of old acting style, acting like an opera diva. It is Salka who gets her into this. And Ninotchka is the only comedy she did, but she's brilliant in it. She was great. And then they did another one. Her last film, Two-Faced Woman, is a comedy. But frankly, it's a terrible film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was Garbo's fault. I think it was the fault of the director and the writers. It isn't well written. And after that film, it didn't do too well at the box office. And the Catholic Church went after her for playing her own sister in Two-Faced Woman. And she was reviled in the newspapers at that point. And then she quit filming after that one. She just left Hollywood and went to New York and said, I don't want to do films anymore. But from the time of Queen Christina on, she said constantly in letters and conversations, I'm a prostitute. I'm here to make money. And partly the money-making part was true because she had no money. Her parents were peasants, poor peasants. She had no education. She wanted to support herself. She didn't, it's complicated the way she wanted to be independent and dependent both at the same time.
Yeah.
But I'm not certain that that's unusual in the acting profession.
No, probably not. Yeah.
Marilyn had some of the same tendencies, and I think a lot of those great stars had the same tendencies. Yes. Yeah.
So what did Garbo do after she quit the movies?
Oh, she was not inactive. First of all, eventually she moves to New York. She falls in love or in whatever with this strange man called George Schlee, who is married to Valentina, the great designer in New York. And Schlee will never divorce Valentina, even though he's really involved with Greta. I prefer Greta. Yeah, and so she's very, and finally he gets her to move into what was the condominium in the day in probably the most elegant building on the east side of New York. And there he's living one floor with Valentina above Garbo. It's a very strange situation. And he and Valentina are renowned for their parties. Garbo basically never holds parties. She entertains friends in her apartment a fair amount, goes out to parties at other people's places, but she doesn't herself entertain. So George Schlee has this strange control over her. He decides where they will go, he decides how they will get there, etc., etc. And she just submits to him. Wants him to marry her. He will not marry her. He says he's involved with one crazy woman, namely Valentina, and he really doesn't want himself to a second crazy woman, namely Garbo, who has huge difficulty making decisions about almost anything, and he has to make the decision. So that's where it rests. But Schlee eventually dies. And then she gets involved with other men and other women. She gets involved with the prominent British photographer, Cecil Beaton, and he spends their relationship introducing her to all the famous people in London, aristocrats, artists, everything. And she has some kind of affair with him, and he is desperate to marry her. And he has a total fixation on her and loves the way she looks and acts, because she can be very ironic, very childish. She performs for her friends as much as she does on the stage and screen, and loves, I think, loves having affairs with prominent people. Then she goes back to New York. Schlee dies. She gets involved, can you guess this one, with Aristotle Onassis. And he proposes to her. She's still with Schlee. Schlee makes a scene over the proposal, although Garbo has rejected Onassis. And then Schlee is forever, he can no longer go on Onassis's luxury liner. So she goes back with Schlee, etc. Then he dies. Then she gets involved deeply with Cecile de Rothschild. And that was quite a relationship. That's a Rothschild. And the Rothschilds have become extremely wealthy through shrewd money management. And there's Garbo with Cecile de Rothschild going around to all the major European high-class resorts. So she winds up a kind of figure of great prominence, personality, and very famous as the reporters follow her antics with first Onassis and then with Cecile de Rothschild.
Sounds like a good movie.
Well, I think so. It's so complex. They'd have to somehow reduce all of the things that Garbo gets involved with. I mean, she's not, I want to be a lone person.
Right.
He makes that statement in one movie, but the truth is she wants to be left alone. She doesn't like all the crowds that follow her, that tear off pieces of her clothing. The stars in the 20s didn't manage their fans on the streets terribly well. Mostly they had to wear disguises.
Yeah.
And Garbo often dressed herself as a man. She did it too, so her fans wouldn't recognize her, but also she liked to cross dress.
Yeah, that's very clear from your biography that she really
had a taste
for that. Yeah.
And of course, we women didn't really adopt trousers until the 1960s. I can remember the transition. I was alive then. And at first, we all considered trousers to be just inappropriate, but then we all went to wearing trousers. So Garbo was, in a sense, before her time.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. So I think it's going to have to be a mini series.
I think so. They've done a lot of documentaries on her life. Some are good, some are bad. They're mostly about her death and that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Monroe is mostly about her death. And Garbo was never a major figure. I don't even know if a film has been made about her life. Maybe, but I've never seen one.
I'm not aware of anything of any quality. You know, there may have been something, but I certainly wasn't. I haven't been aware of anything like that. So is there anything I should have asked you or you wanted to say about Garbo that we didn't get to?
Oh, right. Well, her illnesses, that's one thing. And her spirituality, that's the second thing. And her relationship with just a minute. I had to look up the name.
Sure.
I've got it all written down here. Her relationship with Mercedes de Acosta.
Oh, yes, quite a famous
piece. Yeah. Mercedes de Acosta rose to a certain kind of fame in the 1920s, which was a period when women were really acting out their desires and wishes. It was a period of some freedom for women, both sexually and in terms of manners and dress. This was the roaring 20s of legend. And Mercedes de Acosta was from a Spanish aristocratic family, decided and was an out lesbian. She was very open about her lesbianism, and she was on a quest to make any famous star lesbian. So she was renowned for her sexual technique. And she came to Hollywood determined to seduce Garbo, and she succeeded. So they had a passionate affair for a while, but like many relationships, it got boring after a while.
Oh, sure.
Mercedes was something of a dominatrix. And when she tried to dominate Garbo, Garbo got angry, but she never broke with Mercedes, even when Mercedes was following her across the United States and into Europe, because Mercedes would always run errands for her. Mm-hmm. She'd buy clothing for her. She'd find apartments for Garbo. And Garbo really liked that. She liked someone else to do that kind of work. So their letters, eventually, their few love letters, and then eventually they turn into Garbo telling Mercedes what to do, to buy for her, etc. And, you know, that's kind of a crummy relationship as it develops and as it goes on. Like many love affairs, it's tempestuous at the beginning and then it breaks down. But when it began in about 1930, that's when Mercedes came to Hollywood and talked Salka Viertel into introducing them. And Viertel doesn't want to because she knows about Mercedes' reputation, but she does introduce them and the affair begins and it goes on for a lot of the rest of Garbo's life, on and off. I'd say mostly off, but occasionally on.
We'll
turn to Mercedes, who's renowned for her sexual technique. I think that's why Garbo got involved with her in the beginning. But then, having given in to Mercedes right after she finishes filming Susan Lennox, Her Fall and Rise, they go off to an island, and it's a famous episode in the biographical tradition on Garbo. Then she seduces Salka Viertel, and Salka Viertel writes about the seduction in very open terms to her husband, Bertold Viertel. They have an open marriage. They'd all been in Berlin for a time, right after the Second World War, and in Berlin was a sexually free place after First World War. It was a sexually free place after the First World War. Germany had won. The society was in despair. They went through a terrible phase of inflation and then of depression. So that's where that open marriage of Bertold and Salka started, because it was okay there to do this. Garbo was there, but I don't think she knew Salka at that particular period in time, but she did relate to the open love atmosphere in Berlin. And she already had a lover, someone I'm sure Americans have never heard of. And this lover stayed with her throughout her life. I mean, Garbo had a terrible ability to self-destruct. She was masochistic a lot of the time. It's very sad to realize her masochism. Then she had an affair with John Gilbert, who was the great Hollywood lover in the 1920s. And I am convinced that it was John Gilbert who gave her a case of gonorrhea, which she never really recovered from. And I spent a lot of time tracking down in medical journals gonorrhea, its symptoms. Can you get over it? There was no cure for gonorrhea until they discovered sulfa drugs in the late 1930s. So she finally did get rid of the gonorrhea, but she had these terrible episodes of pain because what gonorrhea does is to, in a woman, is to cause her reproductive organs to swell. And then they swell, they press on the other organs, and great pain ensues. So Mercedes de Costa once said she didn't understand Garbo completely, because Garbo would be perfectly well, happy, cheerful, laughing. And then within 5 minutes, she'd be in desperate pain and distress. That sounds to me like gonorrhea, what gonorrhea would have done to her. It didn't happen all the time, but it did occasionally happen. And it was very bad when she was making, for example, Queen Christina. And her ability to control that illness and to make these gorgeous films, I think, testifies to her brilliance. I look on her finally as a heroine of self-control and awareness because of the way she handled all of her problems. She also, she chain smoked, so she suffered from bronchitis, chronic bronchitis all her life. And that's no fun either. And et cetera, et cetera. There were other things she suffered from. She finally died, they say, from kidney disorder. But I think a lot of other things were involved in her dying. She lived to her early 80s, which is impressive given how difficult her body was and the way that she abused her body through the smoking.
Well, you make a good case for, whatever faults and illnesses she had. It was a triumphant life in many ways.
It was a triumphant life in many ways. And that's what I think she should be honored for. There was a point at which a number of very intelligent filmmakers wanted her to make a truly dramatic film. In other words, something that would allow her to show the range of her acting in subtle ways, but she never did. She did what Salka Viertel told her to do. And frankly, I read the papers of Salka Viertel, and Salka complained all the time to Bertold, her husband. Salka felt that she ought to be the great dramatic star, which she had been in Berlin before she came to Hollywood. But in Hollywood, she didn't make it. She made a few movies and they weren't very acclaimed. So it was a sadness for her too. And she was often annoyed with Garbo, angry with Garbo, but she could keep it all under control. She too had a kind of invincibility to her. And as Garbo did. So I, in the end, honor both of them.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, a pleasure too, Carl. Yes.
And I'm going to go ahead. Very much. Well, thank you. I'm going to post this podcast so that you'll have a link and you can share it with whoever you like. And I'll post it as well. And again, it's Your Biography of Greta Garbo, Ideal Beauty, which is published by Rutgers University Press. Thanks very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Okay. We'll talk again soon.
Right. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.